Governor Walker calls it a great state budget for the taxpayers of Wisconsin. Democratic Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca says it fails the middle class. We will get reaction and analysis to the new $70 billion state budget that the governor signed yesterday from our guest political scientist during this first hour of the show, and I hope from you too. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, July 1st. It's good to be back from vacation. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, to Jean Purcell, and to Dean Kallenbach for filling in for me, and to my producers who work extra hard when I'm gone. We'll have a lot to talk about in terms of what is in and what is out of the two-year budget, the 57 vetoes that the governor made, and we will discuss the most significant of those and try to figure out how this new budget will change our way of life in Wisconsin, if at all. And we'll welcome your questions and your reactions. Do you think this is a great budget for the taxpayers of Wisconsin? Or do you think it leads us down the wrong path? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our first guest, Charles Franklin. He is the director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's a professor of law and public policy, co-founder of Pollster.com, and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Well, I guess Governor Walker waited until the last possible day to sign that budget.
He really did, and Sunday afternoon on top of everything else. So left a lot of people wondering what would be in the veto package that he would release yesterday. As it was, I think it was a fairly narrow set of vetoes, the most important being the bail bondsman veto, probably. A few others, but for the most part, even though it's 57, did you say?
Yeah.
total vetoes, most of them are technical in detail, some with important clarifications. And until we see exactly what lines and what words were stricken from the budget, maybe still some uncertainty about exactly what the implications of all of them are.
You read through the entire document, and they didn't show that. They didn't show blacked out lines of vetoes.
In the 45 pages the governor released yesterday, they did not. They summarized the effect of the veto. If there's a document of the 1,400-page bill with those markups floating around, I'm afraid I didn't have time to read it yesterday afternoon.
And the governor of Wisconsin has a pretty powerful line item veto, doesn't he?
Probably the most powerful in the nation. It allows the governor to strike individual words. That's more restricted than it used to be when you could strike an individual number within a bigger number. So it's an awesomely powerful veto. And over the years, it's had some effect on negotiations between the governor and the legislature. When we have divided government, when the different party controlling the legislature and the governorship, there's a real problem of trust there because the legislature can never be very confident that what it does won't be undone by the governor. This year, with unified government, Republicans in control of both, there's probably less concern about that.
But you mentioned there were a few fairly significant vetoes. You said the bail bondsman veto, perhaps the most significant. That stopped the return of a private bail bonds system for five counties in Wisconsin, a pilot program.
That's right. Now, proponents of it argue that it's available in all but, I believe, four states. And effectively what it does is it provides someone to loan bond money to criminal defendants and assure their appearance before the court. Interestingly, that provision was opposed by the Attorney General, J.B. Van Hollen, and also judges pretty unanimously throughout the state, saying that it would take away money that's currently used for restitution to victims and that it's not needed. So that was somewhat controversial, but with a lot of people in the criminal justice system opposed to it. This was the second budget in a row where Governor Walker has vetoed a provision to reintroduce that. So in that, his move was in keeping with the preferences of the Attorney General and others.
Yeah, and I had read that he had vetoed that in the last go around, but apparently those who wanted this said this would ensure that these defendants would show up in court.
That's right. And that's the argument, is that with private individuals out there with a real monetary interest in making sure people show up for court, that they would do a job better than what the current system does. There's obviously room for argument over that point.
And Wisconsin used to have this system, but apparently there was some corruption and a big scandal when it was tossed in the 70s, I think.
Exactly. Mm. It's been a long time since we had it, but we did at one time.
All right. So another veto that at least a lot of people here at Wisconsin Public Radio were watching was the language in the budget that would have kicked the Center for Investigative Journalism off of campus to get it out of Vilas Hall, which is the same location as the Wisconsin Public Radio studios. And also, it told University of Wisconsin faculty they were not to work in any capacity with this Center for Investigative Journalism.
That's right. It said none of the official duties can be working with that institution. The budget impact of this is virtually nil. We're talking about two small offices in a bigger building. The broader issues from the university's perspective had to do with academic freedom and who controls these things, these decisions. The governor, in fact, in his veto message said the relationship between the university and private organizations, independent organizations, is something that the regent should be developing a policy for. And so in that sense, he's passed it back to them. Others have pointed out that there is a wide variety of university and private organization interaction, especially in the business sphere, where the university is helping on dairy organizations, for example. And so if you wanted to draw a bright line between the university and how it cooperates and works with private organizations, if you did that in a sweeping manner, it could have a lot of unintended consequences. And so that was another element in this. And pushing it back to the regents at least puts it to them to decide what these policies should be. The other element of this is that it's something that was added at the last minute, was a surprise early in the morning, and drew a lot of attention, perhaps drawing attention away from some of the other budget matters, but one that an issue that certainly struck to the struck at the university in a surprising way.
Yeah, and I should point out that Wisconsin Public Radio also has a working relationship with the Center for Investigative Journalism. We interview their reporters. We air their reports on Wisconsin Public Radio. So just in spirit of full disclosure there. Now, there was another fairly significant veto that I read about. It was the governor vetoed some language that would have lifted the enrollment caps for private voucher schools.
Yeah, this was a complicated situation and probably is still complicated. Language was added that specifically affected certain current charter schools in the Milwaukee area to relieve them of the cap, but in the process seemed to open the door that those schools could open branch campuses anywhere in the state that would be free of any caps. The Department of Public Instruction was particularly concerned that this would create a backdoor around enrollment caps and an incentive for Milwaukee area schools to expand elsewhere. And so the governor's veto appears to have closed that door. Still some debate about how serious that possibility was, but the fact that he chose to veto that hopefully clarifies what the situation is.
All right. So no satellite private choice schools. That's vetoed out. The no private bail bondsmen in Wisconsin. That's vetoed out. Yes to the Center for Investigative Journalism to stay on campus for now, but directing the regents to review these things. Any other significant vetoes?
One that is not a whole lot of monetary value, but is an important policy area. The governor vetoed $3.5 million, most of which would have gone for Milwaukee, to tear down vacant houses that have been foreclosed on that are in especially poor repair. The city of Milwaukee owns something close to 1,000 homes right now, not all of which need to be torn down, but a significant number do. And that $3.5 million, while it's a drop in the bucket in the total state budget, was important for the city's plans to pull these houses down. There's obviously a big problem when you have vacant and dilapidated houses in blocks. They pull down the value of the remaining houses in those blocks, as well as fire hazards and crime hazards. And so Mayor Barrett was particularly upset yesterday in his comments that this small amount of money, which is important for the city to control a big problem, was taken out of the budget, coupled with other things in the budget, not in the vetoes, but in the budget generally, the residency requirement for firefighters and police, most importantly, are among the areas in which the city of Milwaukee feels like it has been targeted for some special treatment.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Yes, there have been some complaints that some of this is vindictive against Milwaukee because Mayor Barrett ran for governor. So we'll get your reaction to that, and we welcome your questions and your reactions to what is in the state budget, the new $70 billion state budget, and what is not. And we welcome those questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Charles Franklin, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's going to be a sunny, mild day today with most highs near 80 degrees. It'll be cooler near Lake Superior with highs in the low 60s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Lots of big, exciting changes on Wisconsin Public Radio starting today. We'll talk about them all during Mondays with Mike. Wisconsin Public Radio's director, Mike Crane, joins us after 8 o'clock. And then we'll tell you about Kathleen Dunn moving to afternoons. You will hear Kathleen Dunn now starting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon from 1 until 3. In her first hour, she'll kick off her new time slot with another edition of All Things Political. That's Kathleen Dunn moving to a new time, 1 o'clock until 3 o'clock in the afternoons. More on all of the program changes with Mike Crane after 8 o'clock this morning. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 21 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, July the 1st, talking with Charles Franklin, who is director of the Marquette University Law School Poll and a professor of law and public policy. We are talking about the new state budget. Governor Walker signed the new $70 billion two-year budget after making 57 vetoes yesterday. We're talking about what's in and what's out and how it affects you, and we're welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Professor Franklin, I suggested that I was going to ask you, is this a budget that beats up on Milwaukee?
Well, there are a variety of things in it that some people in Milwaukee, certainly the mayor, are unhappy about. We mentioned the residency requirement that required police and firefighters and other city employees to live within the city limits. That's not just a Milwaukee issue. It applies to over 120 cities and municipalities around the state who require at least some of their employees to live in the area. It's not always police and fire. Sometimes it's executives and others. But the mayor argues that this is a serious blow to the city because it means the employees who benefit from Their pay packages, benefit from their retirement packages, may not live in the city, may not have a stake in the city, don't own property in the city, don't pay property taxes. And so the mayor is quite worried that this will result in an outflow of middle-class employees that are important anchors within the city. Other areas where the state, the legislature intervened, have to do with making it considerably harder for the city of Milwaukee to put in a short rail system by preventing utilities from passing on the costs of relocating utility lines to ratepayers statewide, something that's done in other cities but would be prohibited in this particular case. I think in the broader scheme of things, we've seen mayors not only from Milwaukee but elsewhere express some concerns about the extent to which this budget seems to step into municipal affairs that have previously been the purview of cities and turn them over to the legislature and state officials.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that that are in the budget. The governor says this is a great budget for the taxpayers of Wisconsin. Is that perhaps one of the biggest changes? Is that there's a big income tax cut?
Well, the income tax cut is certainly something the governor has talked a lot about. And initially, he proposed a little over $330 million in income tax cuts. The legislature expanded that so that now we're at a $651 million income tax cut over 2 years. There are additional tax cuts, though not to individual income taxes, that raise the grand total to about $1 billion in tax cuts in this current budget. And so the governor is certainly pointing to that as one of the accomplishments of it. He also points out that the state ran a surplus this year of about a little over $600 million. And so the symmetry, if you will, between the $600-and-some-odd-million-dollar surplus and now a $600-and-something-million-dollar tax cut is apparent. And he says taking the money that we saved and passing it back to taxpayers. And so that's the one thing. The other that deserves mention is that the governor's initial budget proposal provided no increase in per pupil funding for public schools in the state, though it did provide a few incentive programs for much smaller increases. This budget, as it passed, provides $150 per pupil increase in this year and another $150 in the next year of the budget. That is not as high as the $250 per pupil increase that some public school advocates had sought, but it's still an increase after the previous budget made very substantial cuts to public school funding. Yeah. So there are voucher issues that we can talk about as well, but on the public school side, that was money that was added in above the governor's original proposal.
Well, we'll talk about the voucher stuff in just a moment. We do have a caller who's waiting, Tom in Cedarburg. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I had a question concerning the Wisconsin Technical College System. I had heard that about a month ago, Senator Glenn Grossman had put in to the budget a provision that would make it difficult for the tech colleges to continue collecting taxes the way they do now, and to basically hamstring them. And I'm wondering if your guest knows if that provision was vetoed out of the bill.
I'll have to admit I do not know the answer to that question.
Okay, well, maybe we can do a search to see if there's some specific reference to the provision that would have made it difficult for tech colleges to collect tax revenue. Sorry, Tom, we don't have that for you at the moment. And I also can ask Sean Johnson and Chuck Kornbach, who will be with us for our state capitol report after 7 o'clock. And I know that Sean has been immersed in this budget, so perhaps he can look that up before he comes on. We will try to get an answer for you at least sometime this morning, Tom. Let's go back to voucher schools. The $150 per pupil increase in public school spending per year was reached in that compromise, wasn't it? That ended up expanding private school choice statewide.
That's right. The complicated dance here was that the governor had originally proposed no increase in public school spending, but while at the same time expanding to be clear on the terminology, voucher schools are private and religious schools that receive state payments for students to attend. Charter schools are something else, and I don't want to confuse things mm-hmm. by mixing those. And the voucher school program initially in the governor's proposal would have expanded to the 9 largest school districts in the state and been targeted on districts that had at least 2 failing, that is to say, not up to standard public schools. That encountered considerable resistance within Republican ranks in the legislature and made the expansion itself look unclear for a while. The compromise ultimately was what we've talked about, adding to public schools $150 per pupil, but expanding the charter, expanding the voucher program to the entire state, but capping the number of students mm-hmm. at just 500 statewide in the first year and expanding to 1,000 after that. That then will then be with us as a continuing policy issue of whether to expand that cap in the future. So this issue will be with us in every budget going forward, is how much to expand the cap.
Well, we'll talk more about how the new state budget affects education, how it affects social welfare programs, how it affects your taxes. And we welcome your questions and reactions. Do you think this is a good budget for the state of Wisconsin or not, and why or why not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Professor Charles Franklin. I'm Joy Cardine, looking forward to hearing from you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the state's new $70 billion 2-year state budget that Governor Walker signed into law yesterday. We are talking with a guest political scientist, and we are welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up now on 6:37 on this Monday, July 1st. Charles Franklin is our guest. He is director of the Marquette University Law School Poll and a professor of law and public policy. We've already talked about a number of vetoes that Governor Walker made when he signed the budget yesterday, talking about some of the major areas left intact, so to speak. And let's talk a little bit about how some other areas of the state budget are how our life in Wisconsin is affected by this new state budget. And we did, Professor Franklin, talk some about education and how the budget affects education, but not so much higher education and the UW budget. There is a tuition freeze now mandated by the state budget.
Right. 2-year tuition freeze. The first time in history. So that's a big deal. But coupled with that, though, is that the governor had initially proposed about $180 million increase in the base budget for the UW system. Then, as you will recall, it developed that the UW system had a substantial reserve fund or surplus, depending on which term you would prefer to use on that. That became highly controversial, and as a result, that increase that the governor had originally proposed was removed. and some other requirements were added on that the university pay for other things out of existing money. So it means that the system is seeing what amounts to a bit of a cut in funding for the next 2 years, as well as a freeze on tuition for the next 2 years.
And let's talk some. In fact, let's go to a call. We have a call who is going to bring up my very next issue, Lisa in Racine. Hi, Lisa.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I just was wondering about, I had heard that there was a provision in the current budget, and I'm not sure this is true or not, that would allow state-owned land and state-owned utilities to be sold at no-bid contracts. And if that is true, it's very concerning to me that this would be draconianism. Like, for example, let's say Governor Walker had a friend, and the friend wanted to buy some land that was worth like $5,000, but he said, oh, I want to buy it at $1,000. And Governor Walker would say, sure, fine. I mean, I just wondered if that was a possible scenario or if that was even part of the budget provision.
Yes, this is part of the provisions in the budget. It allows the governor to sell state-owned assets. That includes land, but it includes highways, it includes power plants, it includes state buildings. Critics point out, in principle, he could sell the state capitol. There is a legislative oversight provision that is part of this, so the sales are subject to some oversight. But the ability to make those sales opens this question of whether the state is getting a fair market price for anything that it should sell. It also raises the question of whether those sales benefit the state in the long term as opposed to perhaps in the short term. It's an out-of-state example, but the city of Chicago sold its parking meters a couple of years ago for an infusion of quick cash, but now a private company has the ability to control parking meter rates and recoup the revenue from that for, I believe it's 60 or 70 years. So whether the state decides to sell any of these properties is still an open question, but this law now gives the governor considerably expanded powers to make those sales. The governor and proponents of it would point out that there are frequently elements of state property that no longer have a particular value or use, and sale of those assets will be simplified by this. Critics would say, for things like power plants, for example, the costs of buying that power back may exceed the value of the sale. That, of course, is controversial.
I don't mean to throw you a curveball, Professor Franklin, but that reminds me that there were changes made to the stewardship fund. This is the fund that the state can use to buy property for conservation purposes. Yeah. Conservation purposes. And I think there was a provision there that would allow or tell the state to sell back some of the land.
Yes, and some of that was tweaked a little bit in the end and in the veto messages yesterday. But it effectively says if you have farmable land, for example, that's outside of a protection area, can that be sold? So this is a fairly narrow but complicated issue, and one which, like Lisa's question, goes to the question of how does the state dispose of property that it has make that available to the private sector, but do so in a way that's accountable and in line with the goals of the original policies, as, for example, with the stewardship fund.
All right, let's talk about some other major areas. There were some changes made to Badger Care, or the Medicaid program in the state of Wisconsin, that were quite controversial. What happened there?
These are one of the more expensive elements of the budget, and also one of the more political areas. Under the Affordable Care Act, or what some call Obamacare, including the president from time to time, the original idea there was that Medicaid, which is the government, federal and state government program for poor people, would expand to cover everyone below 133% of the federal poverty level. And what the governor proposed, and which has now been adopted, is to cover more people up to 100% of the poverty line, but not above that. And for the people between 100% and 133% who would have been covered by the Medicaid federal expansion, to instead make them enroll in the health care exchanges which are being created under the Affordable Care Act, under health care reform. The governor would say that this increases the number of people who are covered under Badger Care, especially those who are single without children and below the poverty level. But the governor also argues that by pushing people just above poverty into the health care exchanges, where they will have to buy private insurance, though at a very substantially subsidized rate, that reduces their dependency on the government for medical expenses. The concern is that while the premiums are heavily subsidized, the out-of-pocket expenses are considerably higher for people on the exchanges at low incomes. The original health care law didn't imagine this. It was a Supreme Court decision last summer that allowed the states to opt out of this Medicaid expansion, which otherwise would have been funded for 3 years by the federal government 100% and subsequently at 90% of the cost to the of the program. So this is an area that sharply divides Democrats and Republicans, and is of course still a lively debate in national politics about health care reform.
Another big area of the state budget is the transportation fund. What's going to happen there?
First of all, the budget is not particularly supportive of mass transit funds. It's invests less in those, but in highways, a substantial amount of spending. Here is an area where a lot of that money is, in fact, going to the Milwaukee area. Earlier, we talked about how the budget was not kind to the Milwaukee area, but a great deal of this is the Hone Bridge in Milwaukee, as well as the Zoo Interchange. The problem is how to pay for transportation expenditures in the state. The governor appointed a commission last year to investigate ways to pay for transportation. They recommended increases in the gasoline tax, increases in car registration fees. The governor chose to reject those, and based on our Marquette Law School polling, that's what the public wanted as well. When we asked voters if they were willing to pay for higher gas fees for transportation, resoundingly over 60% said no. Asked about higher registration fees, over 60% said no. So there's real opposition among the public to paying for transportation that way. On the other hand, what this budget does do is borrow $1 billion for highway construction. That's a substantial amount of debt and borrowing, bonding as it's called, to pay for these current construction projects. Advocates say it's routine to borrow for big capital expenses, and therefore we shouldn't be concerned about it. Opponents point out that when you borrow money to build a building, you put up the building and the costs of that building pretty much go away at that point, and revenue from the building pays off the bond. Whereas with highway construction, if it's the Zoo Interchange now, in the next budget, it'll be some other road project, and we simply have not solved the problem of enough revenue to pay for the road construction that we need. It should also just be pointed out that the budget also contains substantial money for highway maintenance, especially in rural areas as well as urban areas. So that's another area of the transportation budget.
Well, we will continue talking about the new state budget, what's in it, what's not in it, how it will affect you, how it will affect spending in all of these various areas, from education to healthcare to transportation. The state budget also designates an official state pastry. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Charles Franklin, who is director of the Marquette University Law School Poll, a professor of law and public policy, here to answer questions you have about the new state budget. And we welcome your reactions, too. Do you think this is a great budget for the taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin? That's what it is, according to Governor Walker. But the Assembly Minority Leader, Peter Barca, says that this budget fails the middle class and that it leads Wisconsin down the wrong path. What's your assessment of the state budget? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Checking the weather forecast for today. It's going to be a nice day, sunny and mild. We can expect most highs near 80 degrees, cooler near Lake Superior. Tonight, clear with lows in the 40s and another sunny, mild day tomorrow with highs in the 70s. Coming up on the Ideas Network, it's the State Capitol Report after 7 o'clock. We'll welcome in our state government reporter, Sean Johnson, and our Milwaukee-based reporter, Chuck Quirnbach, who was at the budget signing ceremony yesterday in Pleasant Prairie. They'll give us more analysis of the state budget coming up in our State Capitol Report after 7 o'clock. After 7:30, we will welcome in two state lawmakers, two legislative leaders, to get their takes on the state budget. It is now 9 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Monday, July 1st. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Charles Franklin from Marquette University. And we are welcoming your questions about the state budget at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Professor Franklin, why did the governor choose Pleasant Prairie for the budget signing ceremony?
The company that he was signing the bill in is one that had moved from some operations, at least from Illinois, into the state. It's part of the broader victory tour, if you will, that the governor will be taking to take credit for the things he likes in the budget and wants to take credit for. And, of course, one of those has been his efforts to bring companies into the state from out of state and perhaps particularly from Illinois.
Right. Is there anything in the state budget in particular that's going to aid in job creation? He's still quite a bit behind in that pledge to get 250,000 new jobs.
That's right. The current job creation, regardless of which estimate you use, is about half of the rate that he would need to get to his goal. The budget does include several things to stimulate business growth, or at least that's the goal. It includes some money for venture capital to invest in new companies. It provides some incentives to businesses. Proponents of the budget say that it will significantly affect those, though in terms of pure dollar amounts we're talking about, the specific incentives to industry like the venture capital fund is $25 million. It's you or I would be happy to take that home as a little check, but it's not a whole lot in the state as a whole. Advocates also point to the tax reductions as things to stimulate jobs, but the overall growth of the job rate in the state still lags the country, though the most recent data showed us improving a bit. From 44th into the 30s.
He did not veto that controversial provision to make the Kringle the state pastry.
A bold bipartisan move.
Yes.
That proposal was from Racine Democrat Corey Mason,
right.
Was added to the budget rather late in the game, but represents a rare moment in which a Democrat was able to add something to the budget. But a tasty addition to the budget, no
there
doubt.
We go. There we go. We have some callers, so let's go to Dennis in Princeton. Hello, Dennis.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. What's your question?
I had more of a comment, and I guess maybe a little question at the end, but when I look at the borrowing of funds for transportation budgets, I get a little disappointed because, you know, we build these roads and we obviously have to maintain and improve them as the population increases. And, you know, it used to be the, you know, Republicans would complain about Democrats as tax and spend, when the reality is, when it comes to infrastructure, tax and spend is a balanced budget approach and really is something that I'd like to see the governor and any politician agree to, that if we build infrastructure, we maintain it. And I guess if I had a question, it would be the guest had mentioned that there are significant funds for rural transportation. I'm wondering if those are, if there's increases in road maintenance, or, you know, what substantial funds mean.
There are some increases in the money available for road maintenance, and so that does go to your point about once we've built them, we still have to maintain them. But the budget balancing of the transportation fund still remains a very important and, I think, difficult issue. We are having a very hard time raising the money to provide both construction and maintenance. And as I mentioned earlier, public opinion is pretty reticent to see our gas taxes go up or our vehicle licenses go up as means of paying for it. Interestingly, there's slightly more support for the possibility of toll roads, something that's always been anathema in the state. But it's very difficult to get enough increase in revenue from toll roads that are possible to do that. So that's still a problem. I think the other thing you mentioned that's worth following up on a little bit is to say, this budget takes a surplus of about $600 million coming in, provides $600 million in tax relief, also provides the over $1 billion in borrowing for transportation, and is forecast to produce a deficit of somewhere in the ballpark of $500 million by the end of the 2 years. Now, that deficit is highly debatable, with Republicans arguing that they're budget will produce enough growth to wipe out that deficit, but others are considerably more skeptical of that. Given how painful it was to deal with the $3.6 billion deficit in the previous 2 years to reach what was, in fact, ultimately a balanced budget, we now have moved ourselves into a position where we may not be facing a balanced budget over the next biennium. And so I think there are some worries here, nothing that a booming economy might not mitigate over the next 2 years, but certainly a potential to go back into the problem of facing new deficits with each successive budget, something that Governor Walker had been very proud of eliminating in the previous budget. But this year's budget seems to let those priorities slip to the side and embrace deficits and borrowing to continue the programs that he wants.
Dennis, thank you very much for the call. Let's fit in another call. Mary in Egg Harbor is with us. Hello, Mary.
Hello. I have a question about the tax credit given to parents sending their children to private schools. Is there an income limit on that? For example, parents of high schoolers can get up to a $10,000 tax credit. And admittedly, some private schools charge $17,000, $20,000 per year per child. So can people who can well afford to send their children to private schools take advantage of that?
My belief is that they can, that is a deduction, not a credit, is my understanding of it. And I'm not sure how it phases out with income, so I'm not certain about where it ends. But certainly that is another element of this budget that adds benefits to parents sending children to private schools. And it's much broader than the voucher expansion itself, because it does apply statewide.
Boy, we have less than a minute to go. So, Professor Franklin, does life change as we know it starting today?
No, I think that life changed as we know it 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. The budget 2 years ago was far more dramatic in its policy changes. But I think this budget is still quite a political document. It embodies the principles that Governor Walker and the Republicans in the state feel like they were elected to provide. And it will be controversial, and some of these aspects of it will have long-run consequences in education, in taxes, and in balancing the budget, and we'll see whether growth is, in fact, stimulated enough to more than compensate for the added costs.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Charles Franklin is a Marquette University professor, director of the Marquette University Law School Poll, professor of law and public policy. Thanks to Bill Martins, to Justin Williams, and to Robin Cherry, and to Cynthia Schuster for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.